A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been turning this one over for a while, I think. He's Irish-born, lived in Israel about 10 years now, married to an American from Dallas, and he still finds American culture genuinely baffling in a way he wants help untangling. The thing that keeps snagging him is the politeness. Everybody is so nice, and carrying Irish skepticism plus a decade of Israeli directness, some part of him hears that warmth and immediately thinks, this is fake, what's the angle, what's the catch? He's fairly sure that reflex is wrong, and fairly sure it's actively costing him. The defensive shield goes up, nothing in the room called for it, and the shield is what stops him getting to know anyone.
And he's not hostile to the place. That's the part that makes this interesting. He loves the work ethos, loves that the American dream is still a live idea, loves that things generally work. Coming from Israel, he deeply appreciates the culture of professionalism, so the reverse culture shock is disorienting rather than alienating.
Right. There's a second gap, too, between America as read about and America as visited. From abroad, you get Trump and gun violence, and it reads as a frightening place. Then you arrive, and it simply isn't that. His actual anxiety about a trip is whether he's sorted his ESTA, so he's holding two incompatible pictures at once.
And then the political layer. In Israel, political difference is navigated by arguing, loudly, at the table, and it isn't taken personally. In America, he can never quite work out where anyone stands, or whether he's even allowed to ask. There's an elaborate unspoken code and he can't read it. Plus, Israel has become a charged subject in American conversation, which adds a layer when it comes up. And it does come up.
So the question isn't how to survive time in America. It's how to actually connect with it and with Americans, including across political difference, and including when the difference is about where you live. That's what we're going to try to read today, not the survival guide. The connection code.
Let's start with the politeness, because that's the door everything else passes through. And I think the first thing to say is that Daniel's instinct isn't crazy. It's just aimed at the wrong target. American friendliness isn't fake. It's a social technology. It does real work, and the work it's doing isn't about you personally.
Unpack that. Social technology.
America is a high-mobility, low-shared history society. Most people you interact with, you have no tribal connection to, no family, no village, no decades of mutual acquaintance. In Ireland or Israel, warmth is often a signal of intimacy. You're warm because you know someone, because you're in the in-group. In America, warmth is a signal of goodwill. You're warm because you don't know someone, and you need to establish that you're not a threat and you're willing to engage. It's the default lubricant for a society where strangers interact constantly and nobody shares a grandmother.
So it's not that they're pretending to be your friend. They're signaling that they're not your enemy.
No, that's it. That's the whole mechanism. The smile isn't a promise, it's an invitation. And if you read it as a promise, it feels like a lie. But if you read it as an invitation, it feels like an open door.
Daniel's Irish skepticism and Israeli directness are both reading the same signal and arriving at the same conclusion. This can't be real, but for different reasons. The Irish side reads effusiveness as deflection, a way to avoid saying what you actually mean. The Israeli side reads it as unnecessary, because saying what you mean is the whole point of talking.
And both miss what's actually happening. Irish politeness often is a deflection. It's a way to avoid confrontation, to keep the peace without actually engaging. Israeli directness is a form of respect. I'm not going to waste your time with pleasantries. I'm going to tell you what I think. American politeness is neither. It's a bridge-building mechanism. It says, I see you, I acknowledge you, I'm willing to interact. The content comes after.
The cashier test. That's the one that trips every Israeli I've ever known.
Oh, it's brutal. In Israel, the cashier who doesn't acknowledge you is normal. You put your items down, they scan them, you pay, you leave. Maybe there's a grunt. Nobody's offended. That's just the transaction. In America, that same cashier would be fired within a week. The smile, the eye contact, the how are you today. That's not a personal statement. It's a job requirement. It's the script for the role of cashier, and if you don't perform it, you're not doing the job.
And the direct culture person walks away thinking, that cashier doesn't know me. Why are they asking how I am? It must be fake. But it's not fake. It's professional. It's the same category as a pilot doing a pre-flight check. You wouldn't say the pilot is being fake, because they don't actually care about the flap position. They're performing a function.
The function is, this transaction will be pleasant and predictable. You're safe here. The system works. That's what the smile is communicating, and it's true. The system does work. The transaction will be pleasant. The cashier isn't lying. They're just not making a personal declaration of friendship.
So how does Daniel recalibrate? He walks into a store. Someone says, how are you today? And his Irish-Israeli brain says, this is a question. I should answer it honestly. And also, why are you asking?
The how are you is the classic tripwire. It's not a medical inquiry, it's a greeting. It means I acknowledge your presence and I'm opening a channel. The correct response is, good, thanks you, or some variant. Not well, actually. My back's been acting up and I'm worried about my son's school situation. That's not what was being asked, and delivering it creates an awkwardness that neither party signed up for.
I've done that. I've answered honestly. The look on the person's face is, they short-circuit for a second. They weren't prepared for a real answer.
Because the script didn't call for one. And here's the thing, that doesn't mean they don't care. It means the script has a specific function, and you just broke it. If you want to know whether they actually care, the test isn't the first smile. It's whether the smile persists after you disagree. After you say something difficult, after you're not performing the script back, that's where the real signal lives.
That's a useful heuristic. The first warmth is the bridge. The second warmth, the warmth that survives friction. That's the person.
And Daniel's defensive shield, the suspicion that there's an angle, that's the thing that's actually costing him. Because the warmth is offering something real, an invitation to engage. And if you meet it with suspicion, you decline the invitation. The shield doesn't protect you from fakery. It isolates you from connection. The fakery you were worried about wasn't even there.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You suspect the warmth is fake, so you hold back. So the interaction stays shallow, which confirms your suspicion that the warmth was fake. But you're the one who kept it shallow.
The way out is to treat the warmth as genuine in its function, even if it's not personal in its origin. Take the invitation. Engage. See what happens when you stop testing the bridge and just walk across it.
So that's the politeness layer. The bridge, not the destination. But then you get to the political layer. And Daniel's instincts fail even harder. In Israel, you argue politics at the table. Loudly. It's not personal. It's how you find the truth. In America, asking who did you vote for is like asking what tribe are you in. It's a loaded question, not a casual one.
And the reason is that American politics has become deeply tied to identity. It's not just your opinion on tax policy, it's a signal about your values, your social group, your whole worldview. In Israel, political argument is a sport. You can have a screaming match about settlements and then pass the hummus. In America, a political disagreement can feel like a personal rejection because politics has absorbed so much of what used to be separate, religion, community, moral framework.
So the unwritten code starts with, don't ask directly, who did you vote for, is off the table in most settings. It's not that Americans never talk politics. They do, constantly. But they do it through cues and proxies, not direct interrogation.
Listen for the cues. Someone mentions we're thinking of moving out of the city. That might be a policy signal. Someone talks about what they're teaching in schools these days. That's a signal. The art is to pick up the frequency without demanding the call sign. And when in doubt, talk about the issue, not the person. Americans are much more comfortable discussing a policy position than a party affiliation. The former is a debate. The latter is a confession.
What do you think about zoning reform is a conversation. Are you a Democrat is an interrogation. Same topic, different door.
And the goal is different. In Israel, the goal of political argument is often to win, to establish the truth, to be right. In America, the goal of political conversation in a social setting is usually to maintain the connection. You're not trying to agree. You're trying to keep talking. The win condition is continued conversation.
That's a hard shift for someone coming from a direct culture. You're used to argument as a form of respect. I respect you enough to tell you you're wrong. In America, that same behavior reads as aggression. It doesn't strengthen the bond. It threatens it.
And then you layer Israel on top of all this, and the code gets even more elaborate. Because Israel isn't just a charged subject in American conversation, it's triply charged. It's foreign policy, it's identity politics, and it's a proxy for deeper cultural battles about religion, about American identity, about the whole progressive-conservative divide. For Daniel, Israel is home. It's where he lives, where his family is, where his son is growing up. For an American, Israel is a Rorschach test. They project onto it whatever they're already feeling about a dozen other things.
The gap between those two framings is where conversations derail. Daniel says, "I live in Jerusalem," as a simple fact. The American hears it as a political statement, whether Daniel meant it as one or not.
And the American might not even know they're doing it. They're not being hostile. They're just operating in a framework where Israel is a symbol, not a place. So when Daniel says, "I live there," the American's brain goes to a completely different drawer than the one Daniel was reaching for.
How do you navigate that? Daniel's asking for the unwritten rules, not just the diagnosis.
Lead with the personal, not the political. "I live there" is a fact. "My son goes to school there" is a fact. "The falafel on my street is incredible" is a fact. Those aren't positions, they're experiences. And they give the American permission to be curious without being judged. Most Americans, in my experience, are more curious than hostile. But they need to know that curiosity won't be read as an attack. If you open with a political framing, you've already set the terms as adversarial. If you open with your life, you've set the terms as human.
Let them ask their questions. That's the other part. An American who's never met an Israeli might have questions that sound naive or loaded, but they're often trying to understand. If you shut that down, you've lost the connection. If you answer, "Well, it's more complicated than that. Here's what it looks like from my street," you've opened something.
Sometimes the question behind the question is just, "Are you safe? Is your family okay?" Americans consume a lot of news about conflict in the region, and the human response is concern. But they might not know how to ask that directly, so it comes out as something clumsier about politics.
The "where are you from?" question. For an Israeli, it's a simple fact. For an American asking another American, it's often a minefield of assumptions about race, class, background. But when an American asks a foreigner, "Where are you from?" it's usually just curiosity. An opening. Answer the question behind the question. "I'm from a place you might have heard about, and here's what it's actually like to live there."
The deeper skill here, and this is where I think Daniel's question really lands, is tolerating the discomfort of not knowing where the other person stands. In a direct culture, you find out quickly. You argue, you probe, you establish the terrain. In America, the code rewards patience. You might talk to someone for an hour and still not know their politics. And that's not a failure. That's the design. The connection is built on something else first.
The American code rewards curiosity over certainty. That's the phrase I'd put on it. And for someone coming from a culture where certainty is a sign of integrity, I know what I think, and I'll tell you. That feels like evasion. But it's not evasion. It's a different sequence. Relationship first, position second.
If you can sit in that discomfort, "I don't know where this person stands, and I'm still here talking to them," you've actually achieved something. You've connected across difference without needing to resolve the difference first. That's the thing direct cultures often miss. The goal isn't agreement. The goal is continued conversation.
The dinner party test. In Israel, you argue to find the truth. In America, you discuss to find the connection. Same activity, completely different objective. If you walk into an American dinner party and start arguing like you're at a Jerusalem Friday night table, you haven't broken a rule. You've broken the whole game. Everyone's playing connection and you're playing truth.
Neither game is better. They're just different. The Israeli game produces clarity and intellectual honesty. The American game produces social cohesion and the possibility of working together despite disagreement. Both have value. The problem is when you show up to one game with the rules of the other.
Daniel said something interesting in his prompt. He said his instinct is to steer toward whatever common ground exists. That's actually not a bad instinct for American conversation. It's the arguing part that doesn't translate.
Right. Finding common ground is American. Arguing from common ground outward, that works. The move that fails is starting with the disagreement. In Israel, starting with the disagreement is a sign of respect. I'm not going to patronize you by pretending we agree. In America, starting with the disagreement feels like an attack. Start with what you share, and the disagreement can come later, gently, as an exploration rather than a challenge.
I think we see this differently. Tell me how it looks from your side. That's an American sentence. You're wrong, and here's why. That's an Israeli sentence. Same content, different door.
The Israel-specific layer makes this harder because Americans often don't know what they think about Israel. They have strong feelings, but their feelings attached to symbols, not to a real place with real people. When Daniel says, "I live there," he's introducing reality into a symbolic conversation. That's powerful, and it's also destabilizing. The American has to adjust their framework in real time.
Give them room to do that. If someone's only ever thought about Israel through headlines, meeting an actual person who lives there is a cognitive adjustment. They might say something clumsy. They might ask a question that reveals ignorance. If you treat that as hostility, you've lost them. If you treat it as an opening, you got a conversation.
Daniel's in a unique position because he's not just Israeli and not just Irish. He's a bridge figure. He can say, "Look, I came to this from outside too. Here's what surprised me." That disarms the conversation. It makes it about discovery rather than defense.
Let's pull back for a second. The through line here is that American social culture is a system. It has rules, it has logic, it has a purpose. The politeness is a bridge technology for a high-mobility society. The political code is a way to maintain connection across deep difference. The Israel conversation is a special case of the same principle. Lead with the human, let the politics follow. None of it's fake. It's just engineered for a different set of problems than the ones Daniel grew up with.
The engineering works. That's the part that's easy to miss when you're inside the frustration. America is a country of 330 million people from every conceivable background, and they mostly get along. They mostly manage to live next to each other, work together, build things together. The social technology is doing something real.
The question Daniel's really asking, I think, is, how do I stop being an observer of this system and start being a participant in it? How do I put the shield down?
The shield comes down when you trust the invitation, not trust that everyone is your friend. Trust that the warmth is a genuine offer to engage, and that engaging is worth doing even if it doesn't lead to intimacy. Most American interactions won't lead to deep friendship. That's true everywhere. But they can lead to real connection in the moment, and those moments accumulate into something that feels like belonging.
Before we wrap, Hilbert's been sitting on a story that might prove the whole point, or at least illustrate it from the trenches.
I spent 3 years in the 90s as a cultural liaison for a Texas oil company.
Wait, cultural liaison?
That's what they called it. My job was to sit in meetings between Israeli engineers and American executives and make sure neither side walked out thinking the other one was insane.
What did that actually involve?
Mostly telling the Israelis to say, "That's an interesting idea," instead of, "That won't work." And telling the Americans that when the Israelis said, "That won't work," they meant, "Here's where the problem is, let's fix it." Same information, different wrapping.
Did it work?
It worked well enough that they kept paying me. The Americans weren't being fake, they were being efficient. The smile was the grease that kept the deal moving. The Israelis thought the Americans were lying. The Americans thought the Israelis were angry. Both were wrong. My job was to make them both slightly less wrong.
Slightly less wrong. That's the bar.
You don't solve the cultural gap, you manage it. I'd tell the Israelis to smile more, tell the Americans to say no more directly, and everyone thought I was a genius.
But was there a point where it actually clicked for someone?
There was one Israeli engineer and one American executive who both collected vintage tractors. Found out by accident, the American had a photograph on his desk. After that, they didn't need me. They'd spend half the meeting talking about carburetors and then sort out the contract in 10 minutes.
The politeness was the door, not the room.
The politeness got them in the same building. The tractors made them people to each other. Once that happened, the cultural gap was just noise.
The ones who never found the tractor equivalent.
They got the deal done. It was fine. Not every meeting needs to be a breakthrough. Sometimes the grease is enough.
Where does that leave Daniel and the rest of us trying to read the code?
I think it leaves us with a question about whether the code is changing. Political polarization has gotten sharper. The don't ask, don't tell rule might be breaking down in some settings. People are more willing to wear their affiliations openly, and that changes the calculus. What worked in the 90s might not work the same way now.
But the underlying mechanism probably holds. The warmth is still an invitation. The bridge is still there. The question is whether you walk across it. Daniel's not trying to become American. He's trying to learn the language well enough to have the conversation. And the shield comes down when you realize the warmth isn't a trap. It's an offer. You can take it or leave it, but taking it's how you get to the tractors.
If you've ever felt like the friendliest country on earth was speaking a language you couldn't quite parse, this one's for you. Leave us a review if it landed.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
Send your own dangled cultural questions to show@myweirdprompts.com. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.